From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. An investigation finds Detroit overcharged tens of thousands of homeowners for property taxes. What recourse is there for people who lost their homes this way? We'll talk to the reporters who broke the story. Also, how the polls misread voters in 2016, especially those without a party affiliation.
And of those people who were undecided, 90% of them didn't like either candidate. So you had to sort of figure out where were they going to break.
Two experienced hands at Opinion Research tell us what they learned and how they're applying it this year. And all the new things your autonomous car will do for you while you're not driving it. Like DJing different music for different passengers.
So if two different passengers requested two different things, it was able to pick up on that.
All this plus heated cup holders? Now you're talking. We'll bring you those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, we're going to explore what to expect from the Detroit Auto Show now that it's happening in June instead of in January. Plus, we're going to look at the future of technology in the automotive industry. But first, it's no secret to anyone that the metro area that Detroit has foreclosed on the homes of thousands of residents because of issues like delinquent property taxes. But if you were listening to Michigan Radio over the weekend, you might have heard more about this from Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. The show spoke with homeowner Cindia Windham, who lives in Morningside. The tax bill on her Detroit home was more than three times what it should have been based on an inflated market value, plunging her into debt.
When I found this house, you know, I said, oh my God, you know, how could I thought it was a blessing? Turned into a nightmare.
The new investigative report from Reveal, the Detroit News, and PRX discovered that the city collected $600 million more in property taxes than it should have based on overassessed property values. Christine McDonald is an investigative reporter with the Detroit News, and Mark Betancourt is a freelance journalist based in Washington, D.C., and they both worked on this story with the Detroit News, Reveal, and PRX. Mark, Christine, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Christine, foreclosures have been so common, and there are a lot of people around who have a story to tell about taxes going up with property values. How did you first become aware something was going on that market forces couldn't really justify?
Well, I was on the beat back in for a while. So this was back in 2013. We first wrote a series of these stories that highlighting this problem. We've heard it at that time, 7 years ago, believe it or not. You know, we had heard from so many people that they felt their assessments, what the city was valuing their properties at and what their bills were just way out of whack. You know, that was several years after the crash, after the real estate crash, and they just... folks were adamant that this was not the reality, and that so that's the piece we started writing about. That was pre-bankruptcy, where resources were very thin. You know, that department, the assessor's office, had multiple problems. There were audits that talked about missing money, talked about people just not having the resources, not the right qualifications for those positions. And so they didn't have the resources. It come to find out they had not done what was required, a property-by-property essentially survey. To determine these values in decades. So we wrote those stories, again, pre-bankruptcy, the city or the state who was oversight here, and the county has oversight too, but the state came in and said, hey, city, we're going to take the reins here and require you to do this work. So that's where it kind of started.
Mark, you worked on a segment for Vice News about this early on. How did you get connected with Christine and CIR?
Right. Well, believe it or not, I actually didn't even know what tax foreclosure was starting in 2017. But a friend of mine who had recently moved to the Detroit area posted on Facebook about it. And I started looking into it and pitched this story to Vice News. And I had so much left over that I had learned about the situation after doing those stories that I wanted to do something in a local outlet to try to get more of this stuff out there, and ended up connecting with Christine. And we sort of started working together on these really complex data analyses to try and get to the bottom of quantifying the impact on homeowners of these things that Christina had been reporting on for years.
One of the most interesting things with the story that published last Friday in the Detroit News was learning a little bit more about how you came up with all this data. What do you think was the biggest challenge in trying to get the numbers you needed?
You know, I know Mark has his feelings, but I just want to say that we could go on and on about the challenges. But I mean, I think, well, like when I talked about our coverage in 13, a lot of that was anecdotal. People, we were highlighting stories of the problem. We were, but we were actually looking at appeals. So we did have some data now that I think about it, but we didn't have the hard data that we were able to come up with today. And that was part of the problem. And Mark came up with this idea, and you can talk about it a little bit, Mark.
Yeah, so I had sort of realized that as we were looking at individual properties, I had sort of mentally been thinking, you could just compare the past years to the city's new value after it reappraised the property values across the city in 2017, you know, compare the new value to the old values to see, okay, how bad must the old values have been? And I'd been doing that just sort of, you know, anecdotally the same way, one property at a time. And I thought if we could just get all of the property values across all of these years for all the properties in the whole city, we might actually be able to quantify this citywide while at the same time giving people a sense of how individual properties were impacted. So we had to really just over a period of months try to make sure that we had usable data from the city in order to do that analysis. And one of the biggest challenges was just that part of the reason why their values were so bad in the past years is their records were so bad in the past years that they weren't even really sure what they had and what they were looking at. So, you know, we had to kind of comb through stuff and just make sure that we had what they call clean data in order to do this analysis in a way that was kind of uniform across the whole city.
I'd like to add that, you know, it's important to give people these larger numbers, you know, the $600 million at least, which is a conservative estimate experts have agreed with us on, that that's important. But we wanted to go that extra mile because those numbers are big and are thrown out a lot in Detroit. And so we are able to give home at least the vast majority of properties, put those out and give an estimate on what those individual properties. So on our website right now, you can search 173,000 properties and get our estimate for how overtaxed the properties were over the span of time, which was 2010 to 16.
What's the relationship between the amount that people were overcharged and the overall debt that they owed?
Yeah.
Christine, do you want to? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, go ahead. That was one of the things that we really wanted to do because a lot of people paid their inflated tax bills, which means there's really nothing they can do to get that money back at this point. But people who still owe tax debt, you know, may not owe as much or may owe nothing in many cases. We actually found tens of thousands of properties, about 40,000 properties, that owe less today than the total amount by which they were overtaxed from 2010 to 2016. And so we thought, you know, going forward, if we just had a way to quantify the relationship between inflated tax bills and the current tax debt for which people might still be feeling consequences, be still trying to pay, and may still lose their houses over that debt, you know, that could be a really useful tool for people to have right now.
One of the things that was so totally heartbreaking about this story, some of these homes had been in people's families for years. Mm-hmm. They were just low valued and passed down through the generations as one of the few assets that families, especially Black families, might have. Others were bought by people who were getting a real shot at home ownership, like mm-hmm. Cynthia Windham, the homeowner that we heard earlier on in the show. I know this is the $64,000 question, but how did this discrepancy in taxation go unaddressed?
Yeah, it's a hard to get your head around, but it was, I think it was the perfect storm of events. You had the housing crash, and that was historic. Those values were so high and then went so low that folks just didn't move soon enough in those departments. They didn't have the resources. Prior to that, we had Mayor Kilpatrick's scandal. That was occupied much of our time, the coverage of that trial and scandal. And then we had leadership changes. We had a two mayors over that period, Ken Cockrell for a short period, and then Mayor Bing. So there was a lot of leadership. I mean, I went back to the timeline and trying to remind myself when you cover this stuff, it tends to blend together. But, you know, in 2011, I believe Mayor Bing was warning we were going to miss payments, and the city was going to run out of money. So all this was happening at the same time. This perfect storm, I think. There are still a lot of questions, there were at the time and now, of why didn't the state or the county, which both have oversight, didn't step in soon enough or sooner. And I did talk to Doug Roberts, who is the chair of the State Tax Commission that has oversight, and he did say that they had a sense that things were off, but not to the degree until we started writing about it. And he does have regrets and wishes the state would have stepped in sooner.
It might be easy to look at empty blocks in Detroit and think, well, really, you know, how many people were impacted by this? Were you able to get a sense of how many of the properties covered in the data were occupied?
That's a good question. Yeah. Mark, you want to talk a little bit? I mean, we have overall numbers, but it's just so hard to pinpoint the occupied versus unoccupied because it's such a fluid number. I mean, we do know, of the 173,000, the vast majority of that number were overtaxed. So, and I think it was nearly 96,000 were twice as much as they should have been in those years, in at least one of those years. So, we know those big numbers, but yeah, unfortunately, it's hard to say occupied versus non-occupied. But at this time, you know, over that span, that was quite a span. So and also in the data, sorry, Mark, but you can talk a little bit about this too. We wanted it to be really fair, conservative estimate, and we looked at just folks as of 17 that were getting tax bills. So that this is not including folks who, let's say, maybe had been foreclosed prior to 17 and the house was blighted and was bought by the land bank and is not taxable anymore. So we're talking just folks that got tax bills for the most part in 17.
Mark, anything? Go ahead.
Yeah, one of the advantages to having this parcel level data where you can look at individual properties as well as in the aggregate is that going forward, there is data, the neighbor to neighbor program that the Quicken Community Fund has spearheaded that has really gone out and knocked on doors and found out, you know, how many of these properties are occupied. The county also does a similar process when it notices people for foreclosure, making records of whether or not properties are occupied at that time. That data can now be correlated with the data that we have on individual properties in terms of overtaxation. So going forward, we actually probably could do something like that using all of that data to kind of connect these dots.
Mark Betancourt, a freelance journalist, and Christine McDonald of the Detroit News, they both worked on the story of overcharges in city property taxes. We will have more on this story tomorrow. The city itself owns nearly a third of private homes. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Do you get to a point with election coverage where you see a story about polling and you think back to 2016 and ask yourself, how do they really know? A recent New York Times story named Michigan among the most inaccurately polled states for the last presidential election. Pollsters have been working on new methods to seek out hard-to-reach voters, to find ways to get closer to how voters will actually behave. Today, we've invited Bernie Porn to the studio. He's a partner and president of the research and survey firm Epic MRA, which does work for Democratic candidates and causes. And Tom Shields is also with us. He's senior advisor for Marketing Resource Group, a political strategy firm in Lansing. And he polls for many Republican contenders. Gentlemen, welcome to Stateside.
Glad to be with you. This is Bernie.
Thank you. Thank you for having us today.
Let's go back to the morning after Election Day 2016. Many pollsters, not just in Michigan, had predicted a Clinton win. What was top of mind for you? Tom, could you start us out?
Well, you know, it was just marveling at the numbers. I mean, it wasn't completely surprising. I think Bernie's polls showed the same thing. It wasn't completely surprising that Trump pulled it out. I think what was interesting is that everything lined up on Trump's behalf. It all broke on Trump's behalf. everything that had to happen for him to win Michigan. Of course, you only won by 10,000 votes. You know, everything had to happen, and it did. And it's just one of those things that is tough to predict. Normally, what happens is that those people are undecided, either decide not to vote, or they split their vote on either side of the candidate. This way, you know, it was all breaking towards Trump. I think that was sort of the marvel of that. That plus then looking at where the vote was coming from. People who don't vote in presidential campaigns, don't vote in gubernatorial campaigns, were coming out of the woodwork to vote for Trump, which was hard for us to predict. We saw that support. I think we all saw that support. We had no idea the intensity of that support and the type of turnout that we saw in those areas. I mean, winning counties in northern Michigan by 30 and 40% that you would never expect in the past for that to happen. So I think that's what surprised me the most.
Bernie Porn, how about you?
Well, actually, we were quite pleased with the polling that we did. When we look at the numbers that we had, Clinton had an 11-point lead early on, and when she had her pneumonia scare on 9/11, she dropped down to a 3-point lead. And then during the debates, she was back up to an 11-point lead. And then after the WikiLeaks began to hit, she dropped down to a 7-point lead. And then the FBI Comey letter came out, and some new emails were found about Clinton, and she dropped down to a 4-point lead with 1 week to go. Now, I wish we would have had one more poll the day before the election, or the weekend before, because I think it probably would have shown just as it did in 1990 when we had Blanchard up by 8 points with a week to go, and then the weekend before it was dead even, and I told the speaker when we were in my former life when I was working in the House that it was going to be a very close election, and unfortunately he didn't tell me. He was calling me from Blanchard's office, and he said, "Oh, I'm fine. Tubby says I'm just going to be." I said, "Well, Governor, I think that you could be in trouble, and you could well lose tonight." And the other thing is that our background is Democratic, but actually the 538 gives us a slight Republican twinge in terms of our results. And looking at the way we stratified, we were testing for intensity to vote, and so we did modify the stratification so that it wasn't like previous elections. It wasn't as good as we would have liked. And when we matched up the actual turnout of the election with our numbers with the slightly off stratification, when we looked at that, why we would have been right on the money if we had been a little bit more attuned to following what we were testing and intensity to vote, especially in the rural areas.
I want to, Bernie. I want to get back to the stratification in a minute, but I have another question first.
Sure.
We should note that most polls correctly predicted the popular vote. The issue was the Electoral College. Is there a solid way for polls, or a composite of polls, can get a beat on the Electoral College, which ultimately, in some cases, decides the presidency?
Well, I think you should look at composites of polls within each state, and obviously there are several states that were off. And I think that probably most pollsters are probably going to use the 2016 turnout as a template for stratification for looking at 2020. It would be my guess. I don't know, Tom, maybe you have a thought on that as well. But I think we would use that and then maybe modify it or alter it based on the intensity to vote of Republicans and Democrats and independents in terms of the geography from where they're coming from.
Well, and Tom, I just want to break in here, and we should explain what stratification is for the layperson, what you mean when you say that.
Well, stratification is basically that you take a look at previous voting results geographically, demographically, and things like that, and you try to match up your sample size in your survey to that stratification, so that X percentage of your voters are Republican, Democrat, Independent. Then you also check on age, party identification, and some other factors depending on what the election is. One of the things that we've never really had to weigh in on was education. In the past, I don't remember ever really making any difference because the education level seemed to break traditionally with the vote. But
Yeah, obviously that was huge in terms of polling in Michigan for the presidential race.
Yeah, because those people who have a lower education level tend not to participate in surveys as much as those who have a higher. And in this case, those voters were Trump voters, and so they weren't as represented in a lot of the sample.
Right. Just to continue with Bernie's thought there, Tom, are there things that you've changed in your polling since 2016?
Well, you know, we change all the time. I really think that in the past, we tried to figure out, you know, how the undecided was going to break. It was very unusual to have such a high undecided going into the last week before the election. We were like, just like Bernie, we were at 4%. In favor of Clinton, but we had 13% undecided.
Mm-hmm.
And of those people who were undecided, 90% of them didn't like either candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you had to sort of figure out where were they going to break. And so we just figured they were going to they were probably going to split. But in this case, they decided, obviously, either they didn't vote, which was also a factor in this election that we've never seen really before, that people not voting at the top of the ticket. And they broke for Trump, which was, considered to be probably the anti-status quo vote, where Clinton was looked at as being more status quo. That's all I can explain it. But what we have done is we're going to take the exact same thing as Bernie did. We're going to take a look at the 2016 turnout, and we're probably going to stratify initially our surveys based on that, and then we'll adjust as we go through the process to try to match up with the things that we are seeing within the electorate, the intensity levels. We'll probably do some weighting in this case based on education levels because we think they're underrepresented. One of the things that we did in 2016 turned out to be a mistake was that we were not getting as high of a participation from African-American voters as is traditional in the state. We were only getting 8%. So we weighted an additional 3% towards African-American, which gave Clinton an extra point on the lead. And actually, it turned out that it was right on. We were right on target, and we shouldn't have weighted the data this time. So we'll take a look at all of those things. But the intensity level will be really everybody's trying to judge that because you're not going to know about that until the Democrats pick their nominee. How that intensity level, does it stay at the level that it is today, which Democrats are pretty cohesive and united in their opposition to Trump, but does their intensity level diminish a little bit if their candidate doesn't become the nominee for the Democratic Party? It will be really, I think, important.
And as we saw in 2016, that was the case for a number of African-American voters and some progressives who just felt like they weren't ready to turn out for Hillary Clinton.
Well, thing that I recall is that about the week before when we released our data, I said that it could be a very close election given the trend line in terms of how the race was tightening, and that it could well depend on Hillary's ability to turn out African-American voters. And after that, Trump came in another time, and Obama came in, and Bill Clinton came in, and Jesse Jackson, and a whole myriad of black leaders trying to gin up the African-American turnout, and they didn't do it enough.
And it mimics that Blanchard Engler campaign you talked about in 1990, where the African-American vote was not turning out at all for Blanchard at that point. They weren't excited, and everything was being done in the last weekend by the Blanchard campaign to try to gin up that vote, and they were unsuccessful.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Shields of Marketing Resource Group and Bernie Porn of the polling firm Epic MRA. Gentlemen, I want to ask you both what methods you can use to draw out voters who might be shy about saying publicly that they support Donald Trump.
Well, first of all, I think that you have to make sure that you're increasing your use of cell phones because more and more the landlines are not as representative as they have been in the past, and fewer and fewer people have landlines. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Tom and I are both looking at maybe not in 2020, but not long thereafter, trying to do 50-50 in terms of cell phone versus landline.
Bernie, I can imagine what a challenge that is, given how many people, when their phone rings, if they look at it and they don't recognize the number, they're just possibly likely to just let it go to voicemail and not even pick up.
Could well be. That's why you just have to have a well-planned out sample. And a lot of our success in terms of sampling is based on the guy that we have that pulls our sample, and he does a very good job in terms of stratification geographically, but also making sure that younger voters have more than adequate opportunity to participate in the poll.
Bernie's absolutely right. You need to just engulf as many people as possible in the polls. Where in the past, we have tried to narrow the audience as much as we could so we're not talking to non-voters. I think we have to give everybody an opportunity to get involved in this because the turnout could just be huge next time. I mean, right now, everybody's expecting it to beat the 2008 turnout when Obama won. So you have to increase the size of that instead of decreasing the size, and then within the poll itself, sort of try to figure out who's voting and who's not voting there by these various intensity levels. But Bernie's right. I mean, we moved to 40% cell phones this year in our surveys, and we're probably going to move to 50% in 2020 because I think there will be a participation by young voters here, which we haven't seen. I mean, they voted, 30-35% at the most in these elections. But you may see that in this election, and the only way you're going to capture them is to contact them on their cell phones or go to something, some type of hybrid of a survey, which includes, online. But that creates all kinds of other problems.
Yeah. I agree.
Tom, does the turnout favor one candidate or party or another at this point?
Well, Michigan is a Democrat state. So if the turnout is huge and it's across the board, I mean, it's not higher in any one demographic or geographic or political group, it should benefit the Democrats. I think we've always said that if everybody turns out equally, the Democrats are going to win in the state. But that hasn't happened in the past. It's been more likely to happen in the presidential campaign. But again, we saw in 2016 sort of broke the mold in that you had voters who just don't traditionally participate in the process coming out. And anecdotally, you polled a pollster, you hate to do this. It's like talking to your next door neighbor and judging how things are. But, I have a place up in northern Michigan, and I would travel up there, during the summer. And those 5-acre lots and 10-acre lots and 3-acre lots, like off on the rural roads that had a trailer on them. I go, huge 4x8-foot signs for Trump. You never saw anybody. You didn't know anybody lived back there, much less. But, small businesses that had covered up their business sign with a Trump sign. I mean, you saw that kind of activity that you've never seen before in those areas. And I remember taking pictures of it and sending it to friends and saying, this is incredible what's going on out here. I don't know if this is going to mean turnout, but anecdotally, there are people who are coming out of the woodwork showing their support who don't, who normally are not politically active.
Gentlemen, in addition to the head-to-head matchups, are there issues that you're polling on for 2020 that you think might be of interest?
I think that there's going to be several issues that could have an impact. There's a big debate in the Democratic Party, obviously, about issues like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. Some of the data that I've seen from Stan Greenberg would suggest, who has done a lot of polling in Michigan for Democrats, his data would suggest that the impeachment issue is not going to have as much of a driving effect on Trump voters as will the Green New Deal and the Medicare for All if Democrats end up nominating someone, either Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, who is in favor of the Medicare for All. That is an issue that could be a game changer in terms of how voters are motivated to participate in the election. And that could change the dynamics significantly. I think that that could be a mistake for Democrats to nominate someone who is talking about Medicare for All. And I think most Democrats support the Biden, Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar approach in terms of modifying the Obamacare proposal and improving upon that. And if they follow that and a nominee is not from the Medicare for All, I think that would benefit Democrats.
There may be some ballot proposals too. Who knows at this point in time what may make that to help drive turnout a little bit and get people interested. They don't usually do that, but people are looking for a reason to vote here. They pretty much already have one. But I think Bernie's right. Divisions within the Democratic Party. I mean, just watching the debates, I never thought I would see that. Democrats criticizing Obamacare for being too conservative, and the progressives in the party, are they going to where are they going to be? if Joe Biden, you know, is the nominee. Do they back off? Does a Jill Stein or whoever in the Green Party all of a sudden, get more votes? Or, it'd be interesting. And I think it's more of a problem, as Journey's right, for the Democrat Party than it is for the Republican Party. If you have somebody extreme on either end, what happens to the other folks in the middle? Republicans have frankly become a Trump party at this
yes.
point in time. And, and some of them may be holding their nose. A lot of them were doing that in the last election. I mean, one of the things we didn't talk about here was third-party candidates. I know Bernie and I both had Johnson, up at 6-8% early in the polling. And I think because it was just a place for the conservatives to go and where they could feel comfortable, who didn't feel comfortable with Trump's personality, who eventually came back and voted for Trump and didn't want to throw their vote away for a third party candidate. Stein didn't quite have as much, but she was getting 3-4% in most of our polls. She ended up with 1%. But those kind of things, I mean, one of the things that the media was trying to do was trying to basically get into a two-person race on the polling. And I think it's very important that you include at least the top 3 or 4 minor candidates in your polling this time.
Absolutely.
Because if you look at the two-party polling that was reported in 2016, a lot of those had Clinton at 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And that just wasn't accurate. Neither candidate hit 50% in the end, and she was never there. And you don't know. I mean, who knows what's going to happen with those third-party candidates this time? And do they find somebody attractive that can get more than 3-5%, and where will that vote come from? That will be really interesting. It's got to be included in the polling.
Tom Shields is senior advisor for Marketing Resource Group, a political strategy firm in Lansing, and Bernie Porn is with the research and survey firm Epic MRA. Thank you both for being here. I'm sure we'll be checking in again this year.
And thanks for having us.
Thank you much.
After we come back, what the move of the Detroit Auto Show from summer to winter, rather from winter to summer means, also the latest automotive technology to come out of the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This is the time of year when we transition from the customary December festing into the third winter holiday, the North American International Auto Show. Today, the car and truck of the year were announced in Detroit as usual, but there was no auto show to surround the Corvette and the Kia Telluride with the customary pomp and circumstance. That's because this year the auto show has moved to June. Change is in the air. Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the automotive news site, thedetroitbureau.com. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, good to be with you, and congratulations on the new post.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. Can you recap for us why the show's organizers decided to move the auto show to summer?
Well, I'll tell you what. There are so many changes reshaping the industry as a whole, and particularly when it comes to auto shows, that they really had no choice. Number one, they faced a lot of new competition. Curiously, the one that proved the most deadly was the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, out in Las Vegas, which has become its own, essentially has had its own sub-auto show launched there. A lot of automakers go out because the car is becoming essentially a computer on wheels.
This isn't just lost Twitter energy. This is actual buying attention that's moving to other places.
Yeah, exactly. So the CES show has become very important. Automakers want to go out there because they have a lot of attention from the high-tech world that they may not get at a traditional auto show. Another factor is that, well, of course, I mean, let's face it, nobody really, really, really likes to come in from California or Tokyo or from parts in Germany to be here in the middle of winter. So that's always been a factor.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, so am I. But the other factor that's come in is that automakers are rethinking how they spend their money, and we're. A number of automakers have decided, well, Detroit doesn't doesn't buy a lot of our cars, and particularly with the German luxury brands. And other manufacturers are just saying we can put our money elsewhere, say doing a private show or going to the Texas State Fair or the Pebble Beach Concours, or any number of alternatives where they aren't necessarily fighting against another 20 or 30 manufacturers for limited access to the journalists that they'd like to get to write about their new products. So when you add all that together, there's been a real reshaping of auto shows in general around the world. And in particular, Detroit had to move to try to find essentially a new identity.
Well, the auto show is, of course, a huge deal in terms of the hundreds of millions of dollars it pumps into Detroit metro area's economy. But there's a lot more going on here. We should mention the charity preview that precedes it. It raises millions of dollars of increasingly important funding for metro area nonprofits like the Boys and Girls Club, Mott Children's Hospital. I take it the preview is moving to June as well?
Yeah, it is. And it's very interesting. They are going to try to reshape what that preview is, much like they're reshaping the auto show. One of the good things about being in June, and by the way, we should discuss some of the problems, but one of the good things is you can do things outdoors. So they are not just limiting the show itself to being inside the traditional spaces of COBO or whatever you want to call it these days, TCF.
TCF, right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It'll still be COBO to most of us.
Right.
But the charity preview is going to be doing the same thing. They, in fact, have come up with a modified dress code, and they're going to have two different ticket levels. So I gather you can get a relatively cheap ticket, but you won't be able to see everything. And maybe that means you won't be able to get some of that really bad champagne either.
I've seen this dress code listed as summer chic or tropical dressy. So what are we talking here? Homecoming is chaperoned by Tommy Bahama?
Yeah, something like that. It's going to be definitely a lot looser, though it sounds like the high dollar tickets will still, if not black tie, maybe we'll be seeing white tie, which makes a lot more sense in June.
What's the thinking behind these changes? Who does the preview want to attract?
I think they want to get a broader audience. They want to change the feeling of the event to try to get a lot of the people that don't normally come. And if you consider the tickets are, you know, in the range of $400, there aren't that many people, and the average consumer, the average car buyer, really can't afford to go to it. So I think they're trying to reach out to some people who have a little bit of money, but not that much, and get them involved in the show. One of the interesting things that they're trying to do, too, with June is try to connect with so many of the other events that are going on in the city. For example, the annual Detroit Grand Prix over on Belle Isle. And there's so many other events that, talking with Rod Alberts, who heads the Detroit Auto Dealers Association, the group that sponsors this show, they really want to be part of a broad summer celebration. And with that, try to bring in more people. It's going to be a challenge. So they have to be really creative.
Right. Paul, the show is materializing against the background of 2019 and the GM strike. One of the concessions that came out of negotiations last year is the conversion of GM's Detroit Hamtramck plant into a hub for electric trucks to the tune of $3 billion. Mm-hmm. We've seen other makers talking about their own deepening relationships with EV vehicles. What might we watch for at this year's auto show that might tell us whether the big three are ready for an increasingly electric future?
Well, it's going to be the industry as a whole that we have to be watching. And of course, we'll see that at a variety of shows. The industry is betting heavily on electrification, everything from hybrids to plug-ins, and particularly all electric or battery electric vehicles, BEVs for shorthand. And nobody knows. This is the funny thing. Nobody really knows if this technology will catch on. Sure, regular hybrids are becoming more commonplace. Vehicles like the Toyota Prius is the best example. But when it comes to more and more advanced electric drive technologies, the market is very small. Only about 1% of new car buyers this year will actually purchase an all-electric vehicle. Now, there's a lot of forecasts that say it could be up to 25% or even 35% by the end of the coming decade. And with governmental pressures from all over the world, not just the U.S., but China and Europe in particular, the industry has to move in that direction. They're investing depending on whose figures you trust, collectively more than $100 billion and perhaps as much as $250 billion. That's Carl Sagan type of numbers, to electrify. GM has said it's on a, quote, path to an all-electric future. We've seen the Chevy Bolt with a B, and we're going to see a Cadillac all-electric SUV in a matter of months. So they have to find ways to lower the prices, extend the range, put a charging network out there, and, oh yes, get people excited about the idea of driving electric rather than gas-powered vehicles.
So with all these new kinds of vehicles coming on the market, how big a role do you foresee Michigan playing in their manufacturing?
Well, it's pretty important, in particular, that General Motors is committing to two factories here in the Detroit area, one being the Lake Orion, or the Orion Township plant, which already builds the Bolt EV. That's their first long-range electric. And then the Hamtramck plant, Poletown plant, as we like to call it, as you know, here locally in Detroit. And that will be building a bunch of new electric vehicles. Detroit should become an important hub. What's interesting, too, of course, Ford and eventually FCA will likely build electric vehicles here. But we're also looking at a bunch of startups in the area that are also getting into the electrification business. This is a time when there's an opportunity for new companies to enter like there hasn't been in the better part of a century. But we really don't know. I mean, they're spending a lot of money on stuff that nobody knows if it'll catch on.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's true of so many things. I mean, they told us we'd be carrying phones around with us all day. And I was like, oh, God, please, no.
Well, you know, it's one thing to have a phone run out of a charge when you are at the supermarket. It's another thing to be in Ann Arbor and trying to figure out how to get home.
Yeah, no lie.
It's funny because I remember sitting down with people in the business at the beginning of the decade when the first generation of electric vehicles was coming out. And they would tell me, oh, you know, you only need 70 or 80 miles because, you know, that's more than enough to do your commute and maybe an errand or two. And it was like, that's not the way the mind works. People buy big SUVs and pickups because they think possibly maybe once a year they're going to possibly perhaps maybe need it. And it's the same thing with EVs. Yeah, we don't often need to have 300 or 400 miles of driving range, but we forget to plug in or gas up. We wind up having to run an errand unexpectedly. You know, you're at work, you have only 30 miles of range left, and you have to get home because your kid is in the nurse's office at school and has to get to the doctor, and you don't have the range to do it. So that's... you know, the longer range vehicles will help.
I feel like so much of our traffic congestion policy and really auto industries is hanging on possibilities like this or probabilities. It's crazy.
One of the questions is what happens to the auto industry when all these new technologies come out? So, for example, electric propulsion, the drivetrain technology, doesn't break down. Or it shouldn't. Once they, you know, now that they're getting the hang of it, a gas vehicle pretty rarely made it to 200,000 miles.
Right.
They're thinking electric vehicles could last for a million. How does that affect what we do as owners? Do we wind up keeping them? Do we trade them in? What does that do if it's on the used car market? What does that do to the auto industry? What happens to sales?
Paul Eisenstein of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, thank you very much. We will see you in the aisle where we can pick out our Madras plaid cummerbunds.
I will see you then.
You know, as Paul just mentioned, if you really want to know where the automotive industry is headed, you need to keep your eye on the headlines coming out of the Consumer Electronics Show, held annually in Las Vegas. It is a wealth of concepts and looks for 2020. Alexa St. John filed many stories from CES. She covers vehicle technology, mobility, and suppliers for automotive news. And she joins us now. Alexa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
The march toward electrification, of course, is in high gear. What did you notice about the kind of EVs that makers and suppliers are working on, either in terms of batteries or safety features or just overall functionality?
You know, in terms of EVs, I mean, everyone is looking at becoming more efficient, but also navigating different consumer levels of adoption when it comes to electric vehicle technology. I mean, it's very much so a geographic thing when it comes to EVs. And, you know, they have quite a few technologies. I mean, one in particular that I thought was interesting was a collaboration between Bosch and Bentallier Automotive Group. They rolled out a e-chassis solution as part of, you know, a partnership that they formalized last April. So that's just, you know, one example of the types of things that were unveiled last week. And the interesting thing that I think, though, is happening is automakers are becoming a little bit more realistic about their autonomous vehicle technologies becoming fully autonomous and pushing some of those deadlines further out a little bit. And with that has come sooner deadlines for more EV adoption.
You reported that the technology giant LG Electronics and the software engineering company Luxoft formed a joint venture for production-ready advanced vehicle tech. Why is that significant?
You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, again, these companies that we don't traditionally associate with automotive, such as LG, you know, while they do have some battery technology through LG Chem, you know, it's interesting to see them enter the space, especially when it comes to these younger players or these less experienced, you know, startup companies or just new entrants into this space. Their joint venture with Luxoft, while that's, you know, a little vague right now, I mean, the fact that they're going to start operating in this quarter and they're looking at offering more of this digital consumer platform, I think that's significant because I think that's, you know, a big space that a lot of people are entering right now, looking at different intelligent, you know, services, enabling these connected vehicle solutions, these mobility solutions. I mean, that's really a huge focus right now.
Did you get any vibe at CES of how the industry is reacting to the initial wave of experimentation with autonomous vehicles? I mean, a lot of the mainstream media coverage focused on a few very high-profile tragedies and problems in the testing phase. Did you hear anything about how testing of autonomous vehicles might be conducted in the future?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, especially as Secretary Elaine Chao unveiled the Trump administration's new AV 4.0 plan, you know, and how the government is working on new vehicle technology and policies and getting different agencies all on the same page about testing, especially, you know, as you mentioned, the tragedies that there have been with these technologies. So at CES, I mean, I think there is a little bit of, you know, not hesitation, but people are starting to rethink some of the testing, take a step back in terms of how ambitious they are being with their plans, both automakers and suppliers. You know, it goes hand in hand.
The big stunner at CES seemed to come from Sony, which unveiled its own electric car. The prototype is called the Vision S. Do you get the sense that the Vision S is offering anything really different than what some of the other makers are doing? I mean, I've got to believe the stereo system is pretty sweet.
Sure. Well, I think that might be a key factor for that concept there. You know, I'm not quite sold on it yet just because it was such a surprise. I'd be interested to see where it goes, though.
Is there more to it than the prototype?
Right, exactly. That's the question. You know, I don't think they'll necessarily be entering the automotive manufacturing space anytime soon.
You had an interesting story last week about what the industries wanted to show people they can do with time that they're not spending steering and swearing at other drivers in their cars as autonomous vehicles become more of a thing. What's being offered in terms of drivers' physical space?
Well, you know, that was one of the biggest themes, I think, at CES, this idea of the cockpit of the future, right? You know, what suppliers can do to change the interior of a vehicle in terms of the seating arrangements or the display systems or other configurations. I mean, if you don't have to be paying attention to the road with a fully autonomous vehicle in the future, you know, 10 to 15 years out, you can have more meeting type seating within your vehicle. You can face other passengers. You can have more of a pod or shuttle kind of experience. That's one of the, you know, main things. And it sounds kind of simple, seating, but that's going to be huge moving forward.
What's going on with voice recognition within cars? It seemed like there was a lot of coverage about whether operating systems could be programmed to recognize different passengers' voices for different functions.
Exactly. That's another one along with seating. I mean, I saw Mitsubishi Electric, they offered their concept cabin, a mobility as a service portfolio, and they showed how, you know, one of their AI user experience products could distinguish different voices within a vehicle. So if two different passengers, you know, requested two different things, it was able to pick up on that, distinguish the voices, and provide the correct command appropriately. That'll be interesting for specific individual passenger needs. And others were working on that as well.
Will I be able to program my car to ignore the voices of specific passengers?
That's a great question. You know, I think that will be something that we're seeing. You know, another thing that I saw was with Harman, for example, and they showed a couple of different new technology bundles under this name, EXP, and the audio bundle, for example. If the car sensed a conversation happening inside the vehicle, it would actually turn the sound system down to accommodate for the conversation. And then once the conversation, you know, trickled off or ended, the sound would go back up to the level that it was at before the conversation started. So that was kind of an interesting one I saw as well.
Alexa, thanks for the update.
Thank you so much.
Alexa St. John of Automotive News. She covered last week's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I'm April Baer. That's Stateside for today. From all of us here at Michigan Radio, thanks for listening.